the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to fight this evil.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
I am not making any theological claims at all. I'm not saying that I think Jesus was God. I'm not saying that Jesus was not God. My book isn't about theology. My book is about history. My question is, how did this belief about Jesus as God develop?
That's an excerpt from our latest interview last spring with Bart Ehrman, author of the book, How Jesus Became God. Now, although he tries to back off any claims there about Jesus' divinity, it's quite clear in reading his book and in conversation with him that he does not believe that Jesus was God. He does conclude that, and he thinks he does it on the basis of the history. He claims to be able to tell us how the belief among Christians early and today that Jesus was both human and divine evolved. We're going to be responding to that book, How Jesus Became God, by Bart Ehrman. Dr. Craig Evans will join us. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. A little bit later, Pastor Tom Baker will join us. We'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson today built on the rock of the parable of the wise and foolish builders in Matthew 7 and Luke chapter 6. That's a little bit later in the second hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Craig Evans joins us to respond to the book and the claims made therein by the author, Bart Ehrman, How Jesus Became God. Dr. Evans is a regular guest, distinguished professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Nova Scotia, Canada. He's author of several books, including his latest, From Jesus to the Church, The First Christian Generation. And he's also written an article for the latest Christian Research Journal titled, Why the Followers of Jesus Recognized Him as Divine. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Todd. Good to be with you.
Those first followers, as you point out, were monotheistic Jews. How difficult would it have been for the average first century Jew to recognize the divinity of this man, Jesus Christ?
Well, I think it would be very difficult for the reason you just stated. They're Jewish, they're monotheistic, they reject paganism, they find that abhorrent, repugnant, the idea that there are several gods and goddesses running around. It's a very low view of God. The gods are themselves products of the creation, so it's as flawed as it can possibly be in terms of theology. The Jewish people believe that God is not something created. He's not a byproduct. He is the creator. He is, though present, and there's nowhere in the universe you can hide from him, nonetheless, he is not to be equated with the created order itself. So the Jewish people reject pantheism, polytheism, and all of that. So for someone like Jesus to come along and then within a couple of years cause close followers, even family members, and then ever-expanding groups of people to become convinced in this Jewish setting that he's God in the flesh, that demands of us to think historically. And so in a sense, I agree with what Bart Ehrman was saying in the little clip that you played a moment ago. It is a historical question. It's theological too. He tells us that he wants to approach it purely historically. I agree with your skepticism, Todd, on that. I think there's a little bit of philosophy and theology at work too, in Bart's thinking. But in any case, it is a very fair historical question, and it demands, I think, a thoughtful and very careful historical answer.
What is Bart Ehrman's basic claim in that book, How Jesus Became God?
Well, he struggles, actually, to try to explain how Jesus came to be viewed as divine, as God. He does focus on the resurrection, which is the correct thing to do. I think that's a very important ingredient. He, of course, rejects it, and I think makes a number, stakes out a position along the way that is very faulty. That's what I specifically deal with in the book, How God Became Jesus, the book that Michael Bird edited. And so I respond to that, but he is right to say that the belief that God had raised up Jesus was a major impetus toward the early disciples believing that Jesus was divine. But he really struggles because he has to find a template to clarify that. And so he speaks of angels, sort of an angel Christology, and that is refuted by Simon Gathercall in our book. It's weak. The Jews knew perfectly well that angels were created creatures, that they were not to be worshipped, that they were not divine in any way. They might be powerful, they might be greater in some ways than humans, but they're not divine beings and they're not to be worshipped. So I really don't think that's the solution. So in the end, I don't think Bart Ehrman can come up with an answer. I think he's swamped and trying to find a way out. He resists the silly explanations that others fall into in the past, like there's some colossal mistake of some kind, the disciples went to the wrong tomb, or Jesus merely passed out and revived later. He knows those arguments, those alternatives are very weak, so he doesn't indulge in any of that. But in the end, he just he says, I don't have to explain it. And that's ultimately what he ends up saying, I don't have to explain it. And so he has no explanation at the end of the day for how it is that this Jewish prophet and teacher and miracle worker came to be recognized by his closest followers and myriads more after Easter to be none other than the Son of God, fully divine.
He has a framework that he kind of hangs a lot of his arguments on, and I've noticed it in several conversations with him, but especially in my last on this book of his, how Jesus Became God. And it goes a little something like this. I'm sure you're familiar with this. Jesus never claimed to be divine, and when I gently point out a passage or two that appear to have Jesus claiming divinity or others recognizing his divinity and Jesus not correcting them, he simply says, well, that was added later by people who believe Jesus was divine. It's a pretty clever trick.
Yeah, it's a form of special pleading, and it is any evidence that interferes with your theory, you just declare the evidence invalid in one way or another. And so you just go around and around in circles. And that's why Simon Gathercall's chapter was so important, because he doesn't dispute Bart Ehrman when Bart says, well, the Christology of John is explicit, it's very lofty, and John is something else, it's not particularly historical or whatever. Well, Simon doesn't concede the point, but he says, okay, for the sake of argument, let's not talk about John, let's talk about the Synoptic Gospels, where Bart Ehrman is willing to say this is historical material. And so Simon and others focus on just the authority that you see in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where Jesus says, I have come, I have come. And he says that repeatedly, I have come. And they're in context that suggests that he's heaven sent. He has come from heaven to achieve a divine mission on earth, to do what no angel can do, to do what no man can do. And it involves defeating Satan, rescuing humanity, atoning for humanity's sins, forgiving humanity of sins, and so forth. These are astonishing things. These are heavenly, empowered deeds that he has come to do. And heaven and earth obeys him, you know, as the disciples see. So there is running throughout Matthew, Mark, and Luke, if you just open your eyes and look for it, if you know the Jewish world thoroughly, the antecedent traditions and expectations, you realize that Jesus is acting with divine authority throughout the three synoptic gospels, and not just in a more obvious and explicit way, the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John. So I think that's how Bart Ehrman is to be answered on that point.
So even conceding some of his points about the nature of the different gospels, there is still overwhelming and undeniable evidence that, at the very least, Jesus thought himself divine.
Oh, yes, I think so. Dale Allison, a very respected New Testament scholar, author of a massive commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. He's a distinguished professor at Princeton Seminary, where, by the way, Bart Ehrman did his degree. And Dale, in a recent publication, after surveying the evidence of Jesus' authority and exalted status in the Synoptic Gospels, he concludes his section saying that we should hold a funeral for the idea that Jesus did not entertain any exalted thoughts about himself. And I think that witty statement was right on the money. The evidence is actually overwhelming. And at the end of the day, Todd, the reason we're even talking about this is because Jesus must have said powerful things and then backed up these words with powerful deeds. Otherwise, the Christian movement wouldn't have begun, even with the resurrection. Had Jesus said nothing about himself, had not suggested he was Israel's Messiah or God's Son, if he had said nothing along those lines, the resurrection would have been seen simply as a vindication of the beloved teacher, and everyone would have felt better about it, and there would have been no talk of Jesus' divinity or messiahship unless those elements had been present in Jesus' teaching and ministry prior to Easter.
With about a minute or here before we take our first break, Dr. Evans, how would you explain and you mentioned this earlier in our conversation, how would you explain the fact that the disciples and Jesus followers are kind of blurry on Jesus' divinity, but after the resurrection, they are crystal clear on his divinity? I know how Bart Ehrman explains that. He says, well, they just kind of jumped to the conclusion he must be divine. It worked for them. How would you explain it?
Well, again, to say they would jump to any kind of a conclusion like that because it works for them, I think, is not very fair. It's condescending to the intelligence and integrity of these men. They're ardent Jewish people. They're ardent monotheists. And so Jesus must have done some things prior to his death and resurrection that prepared the ground. They must have sensed in him an astounding authority. And what the resurrection did was confirm it, that despite their worst fears in his death, despite the apparent dashing of their hopes with the resurrection, they realized that everything he had said and hinted at was in fact true.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. He's Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Nova Scotia, Canada, and he's author of several books, including his latest, From Jesus to the Church, the First Christian Generation. He's also written an article for the latest Christian Research Journal titled, Why the Followers of Jesus Recognized Him as Divine. We'll be right back.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Imagine steadfastlutherans.org as the internet version of your neighborhood pub. Your neighborhood confessional Lutheran pub, that is, where the finest in Lutheran conversation is going on at every table and at the bar, sometimes contentious, but always informative and unabashedly Lutheran. We're only serving Wittenberg Ale. We even have a guy named Norm, so check us out. www.steadfastlutherans.org. We'll save a seat at the bar for you.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. The Lutheran Church of the Good Shepherd in Greenville, South Carolina, St. Paul Lutheran, Chatfield, Minnesota, St. John Lutheran, Napoleon, Ohio, First Lutheran, Lufkin, Texas, Concordia Lutheran, Sykeston, Missouri, Hope Lutheran, Granite City, Illinois, Trinity Lutheran, Gladson, Alabama, and Lord of Life Lutheran, Chesterfield, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues, Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues, Etc. 300.
The earliest Christians believed that at the resurrection, Jesus had been exalted up to heaven, and it's at that point that they started saying that Jesus is God, because God made him a God at the resurrection. As some time passed, Christians started saying, well, Jesus must not have been God only at the resurrection. He must have been divine starting with his entire ministry. And so the baptism that happened at the beginning of his ministry is when he became a divine being, became a God. Then they thought about it more, and they said, well, actually, not just during his ministry. He must have been a divine being from the point that he came into the world. And so they started telling stories about Jesus being born of a virgin. So that in the virgin birth stories in Matthew and Luke, which are not found in Mark, in Matthew and Luke, Jesus becomes God at his conception, because God is literally his father. As people thought about it more, they thought, well, Jesus has been God not just from the time of his conception. He was God before he came into the world. And so they started saying that Jesus was a divine being who started out as a divine being, who became human temporarily. And that's the view you get in the Gospel of John. So you can actually trace this view historically through our Gospels to see what the earliest views were and then what the later views were.
That's an excerpt from our recent interview with Bart Ehrman, author of the book How Jesus Became God, his explanation for how, in essence, how the Gospels ended up the way they are today, making clear claims of Jesus' divinity. In essence, disciples of succeeding generations just started making stuff up. Now, when I asked him about that, he said, no, they weren't making it up. They believed it. Well, sounds like they were making it up. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're talking about the book, How Jesus Became God, by Bart Ehrman. I want to get to that claim here in a minute, Dr. Evans, but let's talk a little bit about the empty tomb. I understand that recently Dr. Ehrman online has been doubling down on his idea of the empty tomb, in particular, the fact that the Romans would have denied Jesus a burial. What is he saying? What's your response?
Well, he is saying that the Romans would not permit people who were crucified to be buried. That's basically his argument. And therefore, what you have in the Gospels is wishful thinking, or it's a way of trying to confirm that Jesus was resurrected and that it wasn't just ghost stories where people thought they saw Jesus. So in the passage of time, someone dreams up a story about going to the tomb to anoint Jesus' body, and lo and behold, the door has been rolled aside, and Jesus is not there. And then combined with appearance stories, which Ehrman thinks happened, they're to be explained psychologically only, of course, that this then translates into a resurrection belief. Of course, it doesn't wash. Bart, in his book, appeals to some very dubious claims 20 years ago that Jesus probably wasn't buried. His body was eaten by dogs. You might remember that from 20 years ago. That's been utterly refuted. It had nothing to do with concern about the person who's been put to death. It has to do with the purity of the land. No corpse is left unburied overnight in the land of Israel, right outside the walls of Jerusalem on the eve of Passover. And the evidence is overwhelming, including first century Josephus. He flat outright states that even those who are crucified are properly buried. I mean, so we have a first century source. Evidence just piles up. And I talk about that in my chapter where I respond to Bart Ehrman and his claims about no burial and no resurrection. So he's been blogging, trying to show that I'm wrong, and you know, and the evidence is on his side, but he has no evidence. That's the funny thing, nothing at all. So what he's doing is just trying to argue that all of the evidence that goes against him can be set aside one way or the other. So once again, it's he's indulging in special pleading.
Now, I'm wondering, because when I had my conversation with him, I asked him several times, you know, what you're telling me is it sounds like succeeding generations of disciples embellished the story and, in essence, made stuff up about Jesus, wrote it back into the Gospels or inserted it into the Gospels, or he would say that they actually wrote the Gospels that way much, much later. And when I said it just sounds like they're making it up, he balked. He did not want to say that those later disciples were making stuff up. He said they really believed it. What's going on there?
Well, I know he's wanting it both ways. They really believe something, but they are making it up. So I'm not really sure how you explain that. I guess if you really believe it, then you make it up. I guess you can take a pass on that. But here's the problem with that. Let's just run with that for a moment. Bart would say that the Gospel of Mark would have been written at the earliest, at the late 60s, maybe the early 70s. Mark is the first Gospel. And I listened to your clip. So Mark, we start with Mark, we go to Matthew, we go to Luke, we go to John, and we supposedly see a backdating of Jesus' divinity back to, we begin with the resurrection, we back it up to his baptism, we back it up to his birth, we back it up to his conception, and finally we back him up to the very beginning of time as we get to the Gospel of John. But here's the problem with that. Paul wrote Philippians several years before Mark's Gospel is published. Paul writes Philippians in the early 60s, and he's quoting old material in Philippians chapter 2, the song devoted to Jesus, who existed in the form of God and then took on the form of a servant. I mean, this is a Johannine-style Christology, you might say, and yet it's earlier than the Gospel of Mark by many years. And so this idea that there's this gradual development, it's not until we get to the end of the first century when the Gospel of John is written, as many think, that it just doesn't wash. If you just look at other things, Hebrews could be extremely early, written in the 50s, and yet you have a very exalted Christology there as well. So I think that evolutionary kind of understanding of Christology simply breaks down. It does not agree with the documents that we have.
Now, to the empty tomb in particular, So Bart Ehrman says there was no empty tomb because there was no tomb. He was never in it in the first place. Therefore, he avoids the very lengthy narratives that are in all four Gospels about a Jesus-less tomb, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And as I said, all of the evidence, if you're going to be guided by evidence, we have physical evidence, archaeological evidence, skeletal remains and nails of people properly buried during peacetime. So the idea that Romans didn't permit someone to be buried is flat outright false. And this evidence that I just mentioned, Ehrman does not talk about in his book. He ignores it. And then we have first century sources talking about being buried, and that's Josephus and other sources, including Philo. And then we have Roman law itself, and yes, it's true, it's a 6th century compilation, the Digesta, but the law is old that's been compiled, and the law in it says that under most circumstances, a crucified victim can be buried, and that agrees with all of our 1st century evidence. So Bart has no evidence that would support the idea that in Israel, the Romans did not permit a crucified person to be buried. He simply has no evidence to that effect. But let me go one more step. If we're to believe that the discovery of the empty tomb, those narratives that we have in all four Gospels, if we're to believe that this is nothing more than pious fiction and apologetic, well, isn't it odd the way it's written? We don't have impressive appearances of Jesus to the Jewish authorities who condemned him. He doesn't appear to the high priest. He doesn't appear to Pontius Pilate. What happens? Women discover the tomb empty, and the first recorded appearance is to Mary Magdalene. Now, isn't that odd? If this is all fiction, if it's all apologetically driven, surely fiction writers could have told the story in a better way that would have met the demands of skeptics. And so what we have in the Gospels smacks of authenticity. Like it or not, this is what happened. Wouldn't it be nice to have Jesus appear to Pilate or Caiaphas, but he appeared to Mary Magdalene? She actually was the first one to see. It was later that Peter and the other disciples see Jesus. So to me, that smacks of authenticity, that smacks of restraint, telling the story as it happened rather than telling it as the way you would have liked to have told it to a skeptical audience.
Now, you say, you conclude in your Christian Research article that it's obvious to you as a reader that when Bart Ehrman wrote the book, How Jesus Became God, he was stepping fairly far outside his area of expertise. What do you mean by that? And what would your caution then be for those who would pick up that book, How Jesus Became God?
Well, you know, we scholars tend to be very narrow. We're very deep and very narrow. And that's where our expertise is. And of course, that doesn't mean we can't, as the years go by, learn more things and widen and broaden ourselves. I have done that, and I'm sure Professor Ehrman has too. His own specific training was in textual criticism and learning how to understand and study manuscripts. My own training had more to do with the Jewish world and history and texts and archaeology and Dead Sea Scrolls and that sort of thing. And in over the last 20 years, I've worked very hard in the area of Jewish burial traditions and all the archaeology that relates to that. So it's very obvious to me when a fellow scholar wanders into a field like that, that he doesn't know very well. And when he started appealing, Bart did in his book, to that discredited notion trotted out 20 years ago that Jesus and the other two men crucified with him were not buried, but their bodies were either left hanging on the cross, their respective crosses, for several days to rot in the sun and be picked apart by animals, or at best thrown into a ditch where they were eaten by dogs. That tells me somebody doesn't know Jewish culture or history or practice or law very well. That simply would not have happened. And you don't have to take my word for it. Bart Ehrman's own colleague, Jody Magnus, who is a Jewish archaeologist at the same school where Bart is, she agrees with me. There's not a chance in the world on the eve of Passover, just outside the walls of the holy city, Jerusalem, that crucified people, Jesus or anyone else, would be left to left unburied to rot in the sun or be eaten by animals. Absolutely unthinkable. It wouldn't have happened. Their bodies would have been properly buried.
So finally, with only a minute here, if we look at those primary sources, as honest readers of the New Testament Gospels and the book of Acts there, can we, by an honest, plain reading of them, can we conclude that both Jesus regarded himself as divine, proclaimed himself to be divine, and that eventually his disciples understood and recognized that he was divine there in and around his death and resurrection?
Oh, I completely agree. The evidence is simply overwhelming. The evidence of all four of the Gospels or any one of the four Gospels taken by itself, it's very clear. And so when people like Paul and the author of Hebrews speak in exalted terms, they're not being innovators. They're not cooking up something new. They're giving clear articulation of something that is rooted in Jesus himself prior to Easter. So the resurrection doesn't create Christology, it confirms it.
Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Nova Scotia, Canada. He's author of several books, including his latest, From Jesus to the Church, The First Christian Generation, co-author of the book How God Became Jesus, The Real Origins of Belief in Jesus' Divine Nature Response to Bart D. Ehrman. And he's also written an article for the latest Christian Research Journal titled Why the Followers of Jesus Recognized Him as Divine. You'll find a link to Dr. Evans' website under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Evans, thanks for being our guest.
Oh, you're very welcome. Glad to be with you.
Folks, if you enjoy Christian apologetics, solid Christian apologetics,
You need to get the audio DVD from the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. One of more than 8 hours of teachings there contains Craig Parton's presentation, Making the Case for the Historical Jesus. Now, non-conference attendees will receive the audio DVD for a contribution of $300. Two Issues Etc. before Labor Day. Just click the audio DVD logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or make your $300 check payable to Issues Etc. Send it to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please write Conference DVD on the memo line of your check. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Pastor Tom Baker, concluding this Monday afternoon's program, teaching a Sunday school lesson built on the rock, the two parallel parables in Matthew 7 and Luke 6. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
At Zion Lutheran Church, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, we've adopted the motto, "A Changeless Christ for a Changing World." While many congregations try to market a message that appeals to what a changing world wants, we continue to give a constantly changing world what it needs. A changeless Christ in word and sacraments like the church has done for 2,000 years. If you're in Chippewa Falls and would like to have the forgiveness of sins, eternal life, and salvation that Jesus won on the cross and delivers today in His church, please join us poor, miserable sinners. For more information, visit cfzionlutheran.com.
Whether building a new home, remodeling an existing home, or tackling the weekend project, it is important to have the materials and advice needed to get the job done. RP Lumber offers estimates for professional building materials and services for drywall, decking, siding, shingles, cabinets, and kitchen and bath design to the general contractor and the individual homeowner. Delivery available with over 50 local community locations. For 37 years, RP Lumber.
Hymnody is important, very important. It's an invaluable tool that helps teach and confess the faith. Singing hymns is something we all do together on a weekly basis, yet some congregations find it difficult to sing confidently without the support of an instrument. If you are one of these congregations that can't find an organist, Church Music Solutions can help. Our substitute organist service allows your hymns and liturgy to be played on your instrument to help inspire and support your congregation's song. Keep singing with Church Music Solutions.
Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. What does this mean? We want to hear from you. Why do you listen? How has it helped you? What are your favorite topics? Who are your favorite guests? And what makes Issues Etc. unique? Please leave your thoughts about this worldwide outreach on the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Be sure to give us your first name and tell us where you're from. Issues Etc. What does this mean? 618-223-8382.
Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues Etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and confession and absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback@issuesetc.org.